Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the interaction between modern science and religion. I am your host, Dr. Albert Stets. The theme of the next two lectures is vision. It has some technical material about neurons and brain anatomy. You can skip this if you like. That won't handicap your understanding of the rest of the material. But hey, there are no exams. You might as well go along for the ride. Before I get into the technical stuff, however, I would like to tell you two stories. You can think of them as background material for vision in particular and consciousness in general. Then I want to review briefly the plot from my last lecture, and that will take us naturally into the subject of vision. The first story concerns a construction worker named Phineas Gage. On September 13th of the year 1848, Gage was sitting explosives to make way for a railroad track. The procedure was to drill a hole in the rock and drop in the explosives. Then sand was poured down the hole and compacted with a tamping iron. The point of this, of course, was to prevent the explosion from venting through the hole. Gage was distracted momentarily and did not realize that the sand had not yet been poured. He tried to tamp it, and the gunpowder fired, shooting the tamping iron through his skull. The rod was 1¼ inches in diameter and about 3.5 feet long. It passed through the side of his face, through his brain, through the top of his skull, and off into space. As you might expect, this had some effect on his personality. He was still an intelligent and able-bodied adult. He had no impairment in movement of speech. He had no memory problems regarding his life either before or after the accident. However, he had been a diligent and self-disciplined worker before the accident. Afterwards, according to one of his contemporaries, he was fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanities, impatient of constraint or advice, obstinate, capricious, and vacillating. What are we to make of this bizarre incident? Evidently, the brain has a lot of redundancy. I have a hole in my brain, about the size of a ping-pong ball, where a brain tumor used to be growing many years ago. Perhaps this has affected me in some way, but my friends have been too nice to point it out. The second point is that the brain goes in for distributed intelligence. If you are looking for one spot in the brain where personality is stored, or one place where consciousness takes place, you will be disappointed. And this is certainly true of vision. Seeing, as you will see, takes place all over the brain. My next story tends to a slightly different conclusion. Einstein died on April 17, 1955, of a burst aortic aneurysm. He had specifically requested that his remains be cremated and scattered in secret. He hated being idolized and was afraid that some weird cult would idolize his remains. The autopsy on Einstein was performed by Thomas Stoltz Harvey, a young pathologist. Despite the fact that Harvey was not in any way a brain specialist, he removed Einstein's brain. He also removed his eyeballs and gave them to Einstein's ophthalmologist, who put them in a safe deposit box in New York City. So far as I know, they are still there. He dissected the brain into about 240 distinct blocks, encased in a plastic-like material called celloidin. Within months, he was fired from his job at the hospital for refusing to surrender the specimen. Harvey then took the brain with him to a new job in a biological testing lab in Wichita, Kansas. It was kept in a cider box stashed under a beer cooler. From there, he moved to Weston, Missouri and practiced medicine until he failed the state competency exam. He started working on an assembly line in Lawrence, Kansas, and again, he took the brain with him. He claimed that he was studying the brain in his spare time and would soon publish a report. He kept saying that for 43 years. In the early 1990s, Harvey returned to Princeton. He met a magazine writer named Michael Paternity. they decided to take the brain with them on a cross-country trip to California to meet Einstein's granddaughter. The brain made the trip in the trunk of a Buick Skylark. Paternity eventually published a book about the trip called Driving Mr. Albert. During these years, Harvey would offer pieces of the brain to various neuroscientists. But eventually, he returned what was left of the brain to the pathology department at the University Medical Center in Princeton. So, was Einstein's brain like everyone else's? No, it was not. There is a region just above and behind your ears called the parietal lobes. There is a portion of Einstein's brain there, the inferior parietal lobe, that is 15% larger in Einstein's brain than in yours or mine. There is a neighboring region of yours, the parietal operculum, that's missing in Einstein's brain. The usual interpretation is that during early childhood, one region of his brain grew at the expense of the other. What does this mean in terms of mental functioning? The enlarged region is an area associated with mathematical thought, visual spatial cognition, and the imagery of movement. The fact that the enhanced area is associated with mathematics is hardly surprising, and Einstein was noted for using visual imagery together with mathematics in formulating his theories. The missing area may be associated with speech production. We know that Einstein didn't start talking until the age of 3, and he failed the Technology Institute language exams when he was 15. At any rate, the loss was not permanent. He was famous for his elegant prose in later life. These two anecdotes taken together are puzzling. On one hand, we know that damage to specific regions in the brain create a variety of neurological problems. If you have read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Albert Sachs, you will know of some of the more bizarre cases. We can also speculate that the extra 15% in the inferior parietal lobe was responsible for Einstein's power of mathematical imagination. On the other hand, Phineas Gage's injury left most of his mental functioning intact. You will see as we go along that the brain uses distributed parallel processing on a massive scale. We also know that the brain is sometimes able to rewire itself to work around damaged regions. We call this ability plasticity. Whether these two features together account for the remarkable case of Phineas Gage is another matter. Now let's get back to last week's lecture. I introduce you to Descartes and his dualism. He claimed that there were two substances, as he called them. Today we might say that there are two realms or two distinct ways in which things might exist. He called them body and mind. Body refers to everything physical, but particularly with the brain, with all its neurons and synapses and glial cells and so forth. Mind refers to another kind of reality. This is the realm of the soul, the realm of thinking and praying. It is the same reason as God and the heavenly powers. There is nothing physical about mind, and it has no location in space. This makes good intuitive sense until you start to think about how something purely non-physical is going to interact with something completely physical. Then you have to allow for philosophical zombies and ghosts, and suddenly dualism seems like a bad idea. The main alternative to dualism is monism. This comes in many varieties, but the basic idea is that there is only one kind of stuff, and it's all physical. I'll talk more about this in later lectures. Descartes left us with two other issues, however. He was fascinated with automatons, or as we would call them, robots. He thought that perhaps we are just sophisticated organic automatons. In modern terms, perhaps our minds are really computers. And to push this idea a little further, perhaps we could build and program computers that would be conscious. Nowadays, we call that idea strong AI. That will be my next topic of discussion, after vision. The other problem had to do with vision. Descartes had an idea that the image that is projected on the retina was somehow projected again somewhere inside the brain. We call that the Cartesian theater, and it didn't seem like a very promising idea. But now the ball is in our court. How do we see? This is an important question for at least two reasons. The brain is a very complicated place. I'll describe in a bit just how complicated. And we probably know more about vision than anything else that goes on there. If we could just understand vision, then we might have a leg up on understanding the brain as a whole. The second reason is that vision is still mysterious. Apparently, visual processing goes on at something like 20 separate locations in the brain, and we have only vague ideas about what goes on in them. So, what does the thinking in your brain? It turns out that all thinking is carried on by one very special kind of cell called a neuron. Neurons are ordinary in the sense that they have all the usual properties that a cell needs to carry on business, a nucleus, DNA, organelles, and so forth. But there are two additional structures that will concern us. On one end of the cell, there is a sort of a bush of protruding structures called dendrites. They are actually extensions of the cell, and there are very many of them. A typical neuron might have 10,000. On the other end of the neuron is a long structure that looks something like a kind of cable. These are called axons. Neurons just have one each, but they can be very long. The nerves in your spinal column, for example, are axons that originate in neurons in your brain. The neuron is basically an electrical device. Electrical signals come in through the dendrites, are analyzed in the body of the cell, and depending upon what the neuron decides, a signal will or will not be propagated down the axon, where it will eventually make contact with other dendrites. Here is a very fanciful description of what happens. Suppose one dendrite gets a signal that signifies gray. Another gets the signal for big ears, another for trunk, and still another for tusks. The neuron considers all this information and sends a signal down its axon signifying elephant. I suppose that if you are in elephant country, that information would be useful for many reasons. So the axon will contact the dendrites of many other neurons, which will consider the matter further. Since we're talking about electricity, I need to adopt the persona of an electrical engineer for a moment. The signals coming down the dendrites are analog signals. That is to say, they can have any value, negative or positive, within some range. Some of these signals are excitatory. That is to say, they make things happen. Others are inhibitory. They tend to prevent things from happening. And when you add them together, they tend to cancel one another. You might think of the excitatory signals as simply positive and the inhibitory signals as negative. You add positive and negative together, and you get something closer to zero. This is a slight oversimplification, but it makes the whole operation easier to understand and explain. The other important point is that they are decremental. That is to say, the signals tend to die out as they propagate down the dendrites. Signals that start closer to the cell body will arrive stronger than those that start out farther away. So all these signals coming down 10,000 dendrites arrive at the cell body and are simply added up, a simple mathematical operation. Depending upon what the sum is, the neuron will send out a signal down its axon, and here begins a new phase of the operation. The signal isn't analog, but digital. More precisely, it consists of a series of spikes. The spikes are all the same amplitude, but they come at varying intervals, almost like Morse code, a series of dots and dashes. Part of the reason for making this switch is that digital signals travel faster, farther, and with less noise than analog signals, and the axon signals may have a long way to go. Finally, the signals arrive at the end of the axon, and here begins the most interesting part of the journey. The digital signals are converted to chemical signals. Now I have to abandon my role as an electrical engineer and momentarily become a chemist. There is a small gap called the synapse between the end of the axon and the beginning of the dendrite. The taxon terminates in a little bulb called the presynaptic cell, wrapped up in a thin membrane. Inside the cell are little vesicles. You might think of them as miniature water balloons. But in this case, they are not filled with water, but with one of several neurotransmitters. All this is immersed in a kind of chemical soup containing a myriad of protein molecules and some simple metallic cations. The one that concerns us here is calcium. A calcium ion has two electrons removed, so it has a doubly positive charge. When the axon signal arrives at the end of its journey, it attracts calcium ions into the cell, where they break open the vesicles and release the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Depending upon what chemical it is, it might produce an excitatory or inhibitory signal in the dendrite. The signal then propagates down into the cell body, and the whole process starts over again. Why bother? Why go to all the trouble to convert an electrical signal into a chemical signal and back again to an electrical signal? The answer is astonishing. It's possible to do mathematical calculations with chemicals. In principle, anything you can do with your pocket calculator can be done with protein molecules. Even take logarithms and exponentials, evaluate polynomials, and solve quadratic equations. It's not clear how many of these features the brain actually uses, but certainly some of them. So when I said that neurons did the thinking, that was not the whole truth. Some thinking takes place in the chemical soup surrounding the synapse. There's one more thing I need to tell you about neurons. There are a lot of them, roughly 100 billion. This is a famous number. There are 100 billion stars in our galaxy and 100 billion galaxies in the visible universe. Now remember, each neutron has 10,000 synapses, and each synapse has the capability of a small calculator. That means that your brain contains 10,000 times 100 billion small calculators. I have heard it claimed that this is roughly the number of all the leaves on all the trees in the Amazon River Basin. It is also claimed that if we were to think of a light that was proportional in intensity to complexity, then a galaxy would shine like a dim bulb, and our brains would be beacons visible across the universe. I don't know exactly what that means. I don't know how to quantify complexity, but at least it's fun to talk about.